Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. And welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with novelist Meg Wolitzer, who's the Zale Writer-in-Residence at Tulane University next week. Her most recent book is The Interestings. We'll also hear from Louisiana native Martin Hyatt, whose new novel is Beautiful Gravity. And I'll have a review of Brian Altobello's Carnival in Louisiana, celebrating Mardi Gras from the French Quarter to the Red River. It's a great pleasure to welcome novelist Meg Wolitzer to The Reading Life. Meg's most recent novel is The Interestings, about a group of friends who meet at an arts summer camp and keep up with each other all their lives. She is also the author of The Ten-Year Nap, The Position, The Wife, The Uncoupling, as well as two novels for young adults, Bell Jar and The Fingertips of Duncan Dorfman. Meg will be the Zale Writer-in-Residence next week at the Newcomb College Institute at Tulane University. Meg Wolitzer, welcome to The Reading Life.
Oh, thank you.
We're so happy you're coming. So let's start with The Interestings, your most recent novel for adults. I love these characters. I love their need to feel special, their need to be recognized, their sense of abiding friendship. That's something that's obviously very deeply felt for you.
Oh, yeah. I really miss the characters a lot. I don't often feel that way with my books, but I do feel that way with this one. It was a pretty personal book. The characters are completely invented. But I did go to summer camp, like the characters in this book, and it kind of changed my life as well. And I thought about it for a very long time, about that early talent and early promise, and it just struck me as something I wanted to write about.
And I love their rich interior worlds. One of the characters is an animator named Ethan, who creates this wonderful series called Figland. And Ash becomes a theater director, and Jules hopes to become a comic actress, but becomes a therapist instead. So performance and interaction are such an important part of their lives.
Yeah, I did follow what happened to these friends of mine from summer camp. It was a very arty summer camp, like in The Interestings. I did theater. I was very, very bad at it. Everything that I did sort of sounded like what I called my Katharine Hepburn voice. Mother, where are you? I tried to follow what happened to the other kids I knew when I was at camp, and some of them did go into the arts, but, you know, most of them didn't. A lot of them didn't. And it's interesting to sort of see what happens over the course of life. But, of course, there's a lot of ways to sort of work those passions into your life, even if you're not actually making a living from it.
Well, adjusting expectations is a great theme in this novel, and the world can beat it out of you in its own relentless way.
Yeah, there's a moment in the book, actually, that came pretty much from real life. In real life, I'll just say, I gave a reading somewhere, and during the Q&A, a woman stood up and said, my daughter wants to be a playwright, but I know how incredibly difficult it is to do that and to make a living from it. What should I tell her? And I said, well, is she good at it? And the woman said, oh, yes. And I said, and does she feel like she really, really wants to do it? And the woman said, yes. And I said, well, I think you should tell her that's wonderful, because the world will whittle her down. A mother never should. And I think that's true. I mean, the world has a way of not caring about your plans, and sort of expectations and desires being beat out of you is something that everyone struggles with.
Well, one of the remarkable things about this book is that it seems to me you can read it as a young person one way, you know, and identify with those scenes of summer camp and then move on to the rest of the story. But if you're a woman of a certain age reading this book, you can read it with a kind of rueful recognition of the past and the present. You know, it seems to me it's one of those novels with a lot of entry points for readers of different types.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that. I guess maybe the same is true for the writer. You know, I could kind of write it with both of those things in mind. I feel in a way that you don't really lose the parts of you that you were. I mean, you carry them with you. You take them with you. So for me, writing about adolescence, you mentioned at the top that I have written books for young readers. I feel that you don't lose those sides of yourself. You bring them along. So for me, writing about adolescence is something that feels pretty natural, as well as writing about middle age.
Oh, my inner teenager is alive and well. I mean.
Oh, excellent. Does she want to meet me?
Yes, she does.
Does she want to meet me later? We can sneak out.
Now, I'm particularly fond of one of your YA novels, Beljar.
And you pronounced it right, too. That's
Thank
great.
You. Well, it deals with so many great themes. You know, that first reading of The Beljar by Sylvia Plath, which is such an adolescent rite of passage, and the great teacher who makes a difference,
yeah.
and the various ways that teens cope with trauma. That must have been a really satisfying book to write.
It was. My son, who was a teenager, I think shortly before I wrote it, had been really affected by a book by John Green called Looking for Alaska, who later wrote The Fault in Our Stars. And when I read the John Green book, I realized, wow, my son is thinking about things that I didn't even know he was thinking about. And I kind of thought that the thing about writing for teenagers, and also about teenagers, like in The Interestings, is that what makes it so special is that it's a time of first things happening. It's a time of firsts, when everything feels new, whereas now everything feels familiar, but then you have to make things new, as Ezra Pound said, make it new. And I think I'm really glad you liked it, because you can try to write it in an unjaded way for the person that you were when you were, say, 14.
Right. Now, another of my favorite books of yours is The Position, a tale of four kids who know their parents have written a famous sex book and how that knowledge has, you know, weaves in and out of their lives. And it's wonderful writing about sex, but it's also a remarkably tender book. And I think that tenderness is one of the defining qualities of your work. I mean, I think a lot of people talk about your sharp observations, but I think tenderness is in there all the time, this kindness towards your characters.
I am very glad to hear that. Would you want to put that on a blurb on the back of the book? I'll pay you.
Feel free.
No, you know, I guess for me, it's really about sort of looking at your characters as fully fleshed out people. And once you do that, they're human, they're real. And if they're there just as a sort of construct, a social construct, or there to make one particular point, to hammer something in, that's just not generally the way I write. And the more time I spend with them, I find things that I guess I do feel tender about, whether it's their foibles, things that they just cannot get past. Like in The Interestings, Jules has been criticized in the book and outside the book, really, for her envy of her friends who are so much more successful than she is. And I was sort of asked, well, I'm so mad at her. And I'm thinking, you have to be able to tolerate being mad at characters, and like you might be in real life. But also, I think the tenderness is there once you spend enough time with them. And in The Position, yeah, I mean, I'm making some social observations about the 70s and the changes in America regarding our views of sex and sexuality. But if I did it without tenderness toward the characters, it would just be a tract, mm-hmm. you know, political tract, and that's not fiction.
Well, you also wrote a fabulous article for the New York Times in 2012, The Rules of Literary Fiction for Men and Women. You talked about being at a cocktail party and a man asked you, you know, what you did. And you said, I'm a writer. And he said, would I have heard of you? Which I think is such a funny question. And you tell him you write about marriage, family, sex, desire, parents and children. And then he calls his wife over. And I love that he asked you, would I have heard of you? And you say your answer should have been, in a more just world. So it's been 5 years. Do you think the world is getting any more just? How do you feel about
the
literary world?
Well, you're asking me this after the presidential election, you know, which has turned its focus onto women and the treatment of women as well as other groups of people. And it's a very complicated picture. It can look one way at one moment, and then it can look another way at another moment. But let me just say, within the world of publishing, which I had addressed in that article,
yes.
I think there are ways that things are moving forward. One of the things that I talked about in that essay that you referred to is book covers. And I made a sort of joke that book covers by men had often had a kind of, this book is an event quality to them, because they had all block lettering on them and no illustration. And then you would see covers by women that had what I jokingly call little girl in a field of wheat. And the idea of sort of imagining two men standing on a train platform and one saying, "Hey, Bill, what's that you're reading? Little Girl in a Field of Wheat." Like, those covers seem to keep half of the readership potentially away, and that's not right. So the idea being, as far as I could see, is that books should be appealing to everyone and want to sort of bring and seduce everyone in and make them read about lives they knew nothing about. I think there have been some changes. I think women are winning more prizes. There's certainly an awareness about a lot of this in publishing. And, well, there's a wonderful organization called VIDA.
I love the VIDA count. I know.
Right. So they do this count every year. It's VIDA.org is their website. And they do a count of the presence of men and women in the most prestigious literary publications. How many men, how many women. And some places, like Tin House, a very wonderful literary magazine, sort of said, "Hey, wow, now that it's been called to our attention, we're going to go for gender equality." So I think that there's definitely movement, without a doubt.
Oh, that's so important, that VIDA count. Now, one of the things I often ask writers, and I'm curious to ask you this question, because I often wonder, who's the first person who showed you it was possible to be a writer? Because for some people, being a writer might have seemed like a remote dream, but you grew up with a writer in the house. Your mother is an accomplished novelist, Hilma Wolitzer. So what was that like for you? I mean, did you always take for granted that that was the path open to you? Did you struggle with it or resist it as your destiny, perhaps? You know what I mean? I wonder if you'd talk about that.
I feel very lucky having the mother who I have. I feel that she was just always enthusiastic. And that's something I think that's so important with parents, just to sort of not try to rebut what the kid says, but just sort of listen and then say, "That sounds great." I would always show her my work first and run home and do that. And she was really encouraging and enthusiastic. And she didn't say, "Well, what about this? What about that? Or are you sure you want to do it?" She just sort of thought, "Go for it," in some way. I mean, she didn't say that. We didn't speak in those ways then. But I didn't really question it. I had a brief period where maybe I thought I wanted to be a psychiatrist, and I had a disastrous chemistry class that I did really badly in. Or I tried to teach it to myself one summer, actually. But I always came back to writing fiction because I love to read so much. My earliest memories of reading are reading with my mother, reading Charlotte's Web. So she was an incredible mentor for all of this.
Well, good job. I
mean, yeah.
She did a great job as a mentor. Oh, we've been talking with novelist Meg Wolitzer, who will be the Zale Writer in Residence next week. You can meet Meg Monday, March 6th at 7 p.m. in the Kendall Cram Room of the Lavin Burnick Center at Tulane University. She'll read from her work and then sit for an interview with Professor Molly Polda. Meg, thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
Louisiana native Martin Hyatt's first book, A Scarecrow's Bible, was named a Stonewall Honor Book by the American Library Association and won the Edmund White Award for Debut Fiction. His new novel, Beautiful Gravity, also received a Stonewall Honor Book Award from the ALA. He'll be with us in New Orleans for the Saints and Sinners Literary Festival in March. Martin Hyatt, welcome to The Reading Life.
Hi, Susan. Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be talking with you today.
Now, gay life in small town seems to be your great subject. Are you drawing on your own childhood there, your own experience?
Absolutely. You know, when I first started writing and when I first moved to New York and studied writing, I noticed that there were not a lot of representations of gay rural life. And a lot of the books that were coming out all focused on, you know, moving to big cities, coming out of the closet, dancing all night and, you know, having sex and those types of things. And those were fun books and I loved a lot of them, but I just really wanted to explore what happens to people who don't go to the big city, people who stay in those small towns, what is their reality like? And as I grew older, I did see, you know, those people who stayed in the small towns, and I saw what their lives were like, and I thought many of them, you know, led or are leading very heroic lives, just making a place for themselves in small town America, even though they're gay. So that really is sort of, I think, at the core of everything that I write. You know, and I always think, what if I didn't leave Abita Springs / Covington? What if I stayed there? What would my life be like? So that's always at the core of my work.
Well, the struggle to leave is so great. I mean, it can be so difficult. Beautiful Gravity is the story of Boz Matthews, who lives in a small town and works in his grandfather's diner by the side of the highway. So, of course, life is literally passing him by. He's held down by a lot of things, isn't he?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and I think everybody at a certain point in their life feels that they're in a rut. They feel that they want some sort of change, and sometimes people don't know how to make that change happen. And I also think there is a certain amount of the idea of gratitude in the book as well, about, you know, Boz sort of becoming appreciative of the town in some ways, even though he still wants out. And so I do think, I agree, that is the core of the book, just this idea of, you know, him being stuck, him appreciating his grandfather and certain aspects of the town, and him also sort of dreaming about what life is like outside of that small world he's created for himself.
Well, just because you want to leave a place doesn't mean you stop loving it, you know?
Exactly.
And then in that great list of possible plot lines, strangers come to town.
Yes.
And these strangers completely change his life.
Yeah, and I used to fantasize about that, you know, as a kid. I actually just finished writing a memoir which explores that idea a little further, but, you know, what is it like whenever a, you know, someone glamorous sweeps into a small town? And, you know, I remember the great country music singer Charlie Rich. I think he died in Hammond. And I remember at the time of his death, because he was a huge superstar in the 1970s, and I thought, my God, this big superstar came to Hammond to perform somewhere nearby, and he dies in a small town. I just wonder, what were his interactions with the townspeople, you know, when he went to the store? What was that like for him? So in the character of Cattie Mills, the singer in the book, I sort of wanted to capture that idea of what happens when this glamorous star ends up in the small town. How does that person interact with the townsfolk?
Well, and I think that's a real rite of passage, too. I think everyone remembers their first glamorous stranger. I love that expression. The first time they fall under the spell of the way a person looks and the way a person sounds and the way a person lives.
Absolutely. And I think in some ways what you described, there is romance in some ways, you know, and not always necessarily linked to the traditional idea of romance or love or seduction, but just, you know, how people are attracted to others, you know, and that initial meeting, that spark, whether it's friendship or whether it ends up being, you know, a romantic or sexual relationship as it is in the book.
Now, of course, this is a novel of coming out and coming of age. And in gay fiction, do you think those things always go together?
Possibly, because, you know, I think there are obviously chapters in life. And I do think that when people come out, it sort of starts a new chapter. And then I think even after people come out, then there are other chapters in their lives. So I do in some ways feel that all gay novels in which the character discovers who they are is a coming out, coming of age component. Absolutely. Yes.
And so often it's a novel of going away.
Yes. Yes.
You know.
Absolutely.
Well, in Beautiful Gravity, the reader hopes that Boz will make his escape, but we won't spoil it.
Yes, yes.
Now, I've met you at Saints and Sinners before, and I'm curious to hear you talk about what that gathering means to you as a writer.
Oh, it's just super important. I think it's become the place for gay literature in terms of, you know, what's happening, who's happening. And it's really always just on the cutting edge of whatever's going on in contemporary gay writing. I think I came the first time or went down there for Saints and Sinners maybe 10 years ago. And then when my first book came out, I went back, and I've been back a couple of times since. And every time I go, I feel very much refreshed and revived. You know, I've become great friends with Paul Willis, the director, and he's just wonderful. It's always great to see him, spend time with him. And also, I get to see people that I only get to see at Saints and Sinners that I don't often see throughout the year. And that includes, believe it or not, even people who live nearby me in New York. So I just think everybody who goes ends up having a really great time. It's serious, yet laid back. It's fun. It's invigorating. And I think it's just become sort of, again, the place to be each year for LGBT literature.
Well, I'll look forward to seeing you there. It does have the wonderful quality of a reunion, you know.
Yes, it does. And whatever's happening, you know, whatever books are out that year, those writers always end up being at Saints and Sinners that year. You know, the lineup is always great. And again, the coordinators, the directors always come up with great panels that reflect, I think, the truth of what's happening in the world of publishing. So it's fantastic.
Well, this year, you're one of those great writers there.
Thanks.
We've been talking with Martin Hyatt, whose gorgeous second novel is Beautiful Gravity. You can meet him at Saints and Sinners Literary Festival, March 24th through 26th. Check out sasfest.org for details. Marty, thank you so much. I can't wait to see you.
Great. You too, Susan. See you soon.
Happy Mardi Gras, everyone. As the season comes to an end this week, here's hoping that everyone caught lots of great throws and enjoyed their carnival traditions. While we often think of New Orleans as Carnival Central, it's good to remember that every part of the state has its own idiosyncratic celebrations. That's what Brian Altobello, historian and 2009 King of the New Roads Lions Mardi Gras Carnival, reminds us in his new book, Carnival in Louisiana, celebrating Mardi Gras from the French Quarter to the Red River. This is a fine survey of the season, starting with New Orleans, of course, and moving around the state, with sections devoted to Acadiana, Southeast and Central Louisiana, and Central and North Louisiana. As a New Orleanian, I wish for a bit more on the growing contributions of women to carnival, especially muses and nicks and femme fatale, and the resurgence of the baby dolls, but that's a small complaint. What is so fascinating about Altobello's book is to see how these celebrations have grown organically, suited to their particular settings. What I love most about Carnival is the common efforts of heart and hand that go into it. From the time the parade planning takes, the investment of crew members, the crafting of handmade throws, from glitter shoes to coconuts and purses. Altobello's book celebrates the way Carnival brings us together and offers something for everyone. He chronicles the growth of African-American crews, diverse marching groups, the way a children's parade is usually a part of the event, and the way we even include our pets with parades of their own. Carnival in Louisiana invites you to take a look at the holidays statewide. Maybe you'd like to break with your New Orleans tradition some year and pay homage to Queen Hyacinth and Homa in a parade with floral touches. Or pay a visit to the Iberville Parish Library, which has its own royalty. Or chase the chicken in Acadiana. This joyful, comprehensive look at the strong cultural ties that bind Louisianans is a charmer. Throw it to the carnival lover in your life.
Because you know I'm all about those books, start reading. I'm all about those books, start reading. I'm all about those books, start reading. I'm all about those books. Yeah, it's pretty clear that I'm really cool. Because I'm reading, reading, it's what I like to do. Cause I got that fiction that everyone's chasing. All of these books take you so many places. I see those magazines, they making reading hot. They're great when time is short and you can even swap. If you got books or Kindles, just raise them up. Cause anything you read is perfect from the start until the stop. Yeah, Devon said she told me don't worry about the size. She says Goodreads like lots of books to read a night. You know I won't be no closed-minded, blank-looking Barbie doll. So if that's what you're into, then go ahead and move along. Because because you know I'm all about those books, start reading. I'm all about those books, start reading. I'm all about those books, start reading. I'm all about those books, hey, I'm bringing reading back.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Kathleen Grissom signs the paperback edition of her novel Glory Over Everything, Thursday, March 2nd at 6 at Octavia Books. Dr. Elvira Cassell discusses More Than a Novel, Abduction and the Heroine of Northanger Abbey. That's at the Jane Austen Society of North America, Louisiana Region, March meeting, Saturday, March 4th from 10:30 to noon at the Rosa Keller Library. Diane de las Casas and John Correa read and sign Captain Deadeye, The Bully Shark, Saturday, March 4th at 10:30 at Maple Street Bookshop. The Friends of the Terrebonne Parish Public Library sponsor the 14th Annual Jambalaya Writers Conference, set for March 4th at the Terrebonne Parish Main Library in Houma. Writers across all genres will guide both new and practiced writers in their craft. This year features Lisa Unger, Jeff Lindsay, author of the Dexter novels, Rachel Kane, romance writers Alexandria Weiss and Farah Roshan, Roland Paris of Marvel Comics, My Sunshine Away author Emma Walsh, Nicholas Maneri, Ashley Elston, Elise Arden, Kim Vaz DeVille, and many more. Poetry and fiction contest submissions are due by February 10th, and for more information or to register, go to mytpl.org. Today's guest, Meg Wolitzer, whose most recent novel is The Interestings, will be the Zale Kimmerling Writer in Residence March 6th through 9th at the Newcomb College Institute at Tulane University. She will present a reading and sit for an interview with Tulane professor Molly Pulda, Monday, March 6th at 7 at the Kindlecram Room in the Lavin Burnick Center. The Friends of the Jefferson Public Library conduct its semi-annual Big Book Sale from Thursday, March 9th to Sunday, March 12th at the Pontchartrain Center, Williams Boulevard at the Lake. Hours are 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. Thursday through Saturday, March 9th through 11th, and noon to 5 on Sunday, March 12th. Also coming up, novelist Colson Whitehead, whose most recent book is the National Book Award winner, The Underground Railroad, appears Thursday, March 9th for a discussion and Q&A, moderated by WWL-TV's Sheba Turk, from 7 to 8:30, followed by a book signing at 8:30. That's at the New Orleans Advocate Office, 840 St. Charles Avenue. For a complimentary ticket to the discussion, go to nolalibrary.org or any New Orleans Public Library location. Anyone can attend the book signing. And later on in March, get ready for the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival, March 22nd through 26th, with special guests Jamie Attenberg, Roy Blunt Jr., Rick Bragg, Patricia Bosworth, Robert Olin Butler, Dick Cavett, Amy Dickinson, Wally Lamb, and many others. Masterclasses start on March 23rd, so sign up for limited admission events with some of your favorite writers. For more information, check out TennesseeWilliams.net. The schedule is online now. Saints and Sinners, the festival for LGBT writers and readers, takes place March 24th through 26th. Check out sasfest.org for info. And tickets are already on sale for Walker Percy Weekend in St. Francisville, June 2nd through 4th. For information about speakers and events, check out walkerpercyweekend.org. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.